This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The secret of abundance. Now, it seems to me in perilous times of economic questionability, the idea of secret abundance would be a big box office draw. How come that isn't in your title? Is it a different kind of abundance?
Well, yes. See, part of what's happened in a way you could imagine is the path of economics, right, which has always been there as the marketplace, which would be the simpler term, has become a tremendous focal point, perhaps more than it can bear. And then secondly, there has been a collapse of imagination so that people think that economic issues have to be worked out on an economic level. And what I'm trying to say is the bigger abundance of the world has to do with imagination, and it has to do with soul, and it has to do with spirit, and it has to do with people finding the story that's meaningful to them and then living it out. And when those things are brought to bear, the economics begin to flow better. For instance, the idea that there could be unemployment in this country is a little bit absurd if you consider the fact of how much need there is throughout the culture, homeless people, young people getting pulled into addictions, diseases with no end to them, all this kind of stuff. There is so much possible employment in the areas of all the institutions that are failing and in the areas of great human need. And then in nature, where you have climate change, melting ice poles and all that kind of stuff, changes in the ecologies and the environments, and there are people who are naturally drawn to that. There are students in school right now who are being led through courses of study that are a little bit old hand, who have in them the seeds of imagination to figure out how to change the environment and help nature find balance again. And that's what I mean by abundance. The abundance is the seeds of imagination and the naturally inclined goals that people are born with. And when those things are drawn on, suddenly the world doesn't seem like a collapsed economic failure, but it seems like a place of dreams and imagination. And until it becomes that again, people are going to be stuck like the Congress is stuck. It's not that there are no answers. It's that the answers have to be found through imagination, not through ideology.
So the subtitle of the workshop, The Pathless Path, that you're doing in Portland this weekend, says Following Spirit, Making Soul. As I understand it, spirit is an upward direction and soul is a downward and deepening direction. How do you go in two directions at once?
You do it alternatively. Although, sometimes in a real life-changing event, you're pulled both ways at the same time. But the old alchemical idea was circulatio, they called it. And that meant that you enter the high-spirited area of things, which, like you said, rises up. And as you rise up, you can imagine that that has to do with inspiration. It has to do with real ideas that suddenly strike a person or that arise from within them. And it has to do with growing up and with building things up and gathering things in an upward, meaningful way. But a person can only do that a certain amount of time, and this is what's not understood about both economics and people. And then what has to happen is the curve has to go the other way. And then it goes down, and it goes into, as you said, deepening. And imagine that if a person is going to have a big spirit, which most people naturally would have, you have to have a depth of soul that balances and allows you to carry that spiritual or even carry big ideas. And so the curve goes down, and now a person is in the opposite place. They're in the place of not spiritual high ideals and ideas, but now they're in the place of earth wisdom and body intelligence and also the depths of feeling that are natural to the soul. When you get people who have big ideas or big spiritual charges who do not have the depth of soul, those big ideas can become dangerous to everybody because they're not grounded in compassion and grounded in empathy and grounded in a deep understanding of what everyone goes through in the struggle of life. So I'm taking the idea that there are times collectively and individually where we have to allow ourselves to be pulled into bigger ideas and bigger movements and bigger thoughts. And then there are times where we have to allow ourselves to be pulled down into deeper understandings and deeper feelings.
Can you speak to the value of meeting in community, as it were, at events such as yours? In my personal experience of doing some of your work, being in a room with a couple hundred people cooks us all faster and more thoroughly. And you get many reflections of various parts of stories and poems and chants and all that. And like I said, there's just more to it. And if I remember some of my anthropology, that's the way storytelling and cultural learning used to happen in public, in groups, over and over.
Yeah, that is the natural thing. And one of the functions of story is to bring everybody together inside a container that is like a symbolic representation of how we're connected. So we're all in the same story for an evening or a day, but we're all seeing it differently. So we get the best of both things. Our particular unique view, which is valuable not just to us, but to the community, and our way of being together, which kind of validates those unique views, but also gives us this extra energy of learning. And you were making me think of Rumi, who says something to the effect of, on our own, we climb the hills of learning, but when we go together, we move much more quickly and deeply at the same time. And so there's a real confusion in modern American thinking about the difference between the individual and the community, which now comes into some of these right-wing and libertarian issues of, you know, the individual's rights against the community's rights, and so on. And those things are actually deep ideas that have to get solved each generation. But the old idea is that the community needs the individual at their best, and the individual at their best needs to be recognized and supported by the community. And it's so deep in human nature that, like you said, a couple of hundred people have come together for an evening, and we all feel better by virtue of just being together and being honest and being in the state of shared imagination.
I was really impressed by the idea that the gifts that we discover and through our own work, your type of work, counseling, whatever it is, need to have a community to give the gifts to. It's not enough to just know what your particular, I'll use one of the terms you like to use, genius is. You have to have a place to apply it. And I think in rugged individualism of the sort that Margaret Thatcher was referencing when she made comments that said, or she said, paraphrasing here, there is no society, there are individuals and families. And if you remember last year's election, Mr. Romney suggested that while Barack Obama talked about halting global warming and keeping the oceans from rising, all he promised was to help you and your family.
Interesting, yeah. I call it ragged individualism because that's where it winds up.
I'm wearing mine right now.
And it gives just the excuse, you know, like ideologies do the same thing. They give people the excuse to dismiss the humanity of those they don't agree with. That's what's going on, mm-hmm. You know. And so someone rises to the top, and they have every opportunity, and they have every exercise of power, and they say it's all about the individual. That's, you know, it's like low-level psychology. It's not deep enough. When a person rises to the top, as Obama tried to argue and got criticized for, there have been lots of helping hands. And the only people who say that that's not true are Donald Trump and his ilk, who try to trump everybody by constantly reaffirming their self-importance. Everybody else understands, and even the surveys they take now, you know, they survey or interrogate or whatever, interview, I guess is the right word, these really successful people and say, well, how did you get here? And any of the ones that are even partially awake say, well, there was a teacher in fifth grade. There was a mentor I had. There was an opportunity given to me. And so the community has always been involved in the rise of the individuals. And individual, by the way, means undivided. That's the meaning of the word. And so when a person gets to a place of fulfillment, they're supposed to be undivided. And the undivided person will act in the interest of community unity rather than the interest of dividing into factions. And so one way to critique the people on top, if they have the option, the opportunity to use power, and they're not using it for, to create unity and benefit for other people, then they are not truly an individual. They are still divided, and they are acting out that inner division.
So one of the ways to help people on their path to being whole and united is through mentoring, which is a big part of the work that Mosaic does and has done for decades. What's a mentor?
Good question. These are good questions.
Really, really basic. Thank you.
Yes, the word enters the English language at the beginning of the Odyssey. And a lot of, you know, people say the Odyssey is the story of the Western world, always trying to return from war and always getting lost. And Ulysses is on his, he's lost. He can't get back from the big war. And his son, the young prince, is on the shore lamenting. He's 15 years old, and he's lamenting that he can't help the community, which is being ravaged by you know, the people who have taken over while Ulysses the king is gone. We would probably call them, you know, the Tea Party or something. Just kidding. Anyway, they've taken over because the real noble leadership is missing, and young Telemachus is his name. He's feeling too young and weak to act in the unifying role that his father once had. And along the beach, he's crying out to the sea, actually, lamenting. And you imagine young women and young men right now in a culture. They're growing up. They're watching what's going on. They're seeing people. You know, we have the greatest disparity in the United States economy, I think, since the 20s that led to, you know, the big downfall. And the Great Gatsby just came out again, as a movie. But what's interesting about that movie, in a way, or that book, is that it was about that a period when the disparity between rich and poor was slightly higher than it is now. So it's almost as if the movie says, oh, we're back there again. And young people are rising up into a culture where they can't help but recognize that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, that there are injustices of all kinds, and a kind of increasing amount of violence and support of violence and all that kind of stuff. So in a way, the prince on the shore is each young woman and each young man lamenting, wow, I'm too young to do anything. Why can't someone do something? What happens? And along comes an old sailor named Mentor. And that's how Mentor enters Western literature. And it's significant that he's a sailor, which means that he knows how the seas go up and the seas go down. And the old statement is, and I don't do much sailing, just enough to understand the truth of this, the ship is always off course. All sailing is about correcting to the course, and the ship is always off course. So here comes the one, the old salt, who has the salty knowledge of how this thing works, and he begins to talk to the young prince. And then the critical moment is, as he advises the young prince, who represents the nobility of each girl and each boy, the Odyssey says, the goddess Athena, goddess of wisdom, enters him and speaks through him. So now there's three of them there on the shores of confusion. The young noble person who wants to do the best for everybody, the old salt who knows how this stuff works, and the two of them together draws in the energy of the goddess of wisdom, who then gives guidance through the old salt to the young seeker. And so, I'd add one more thing. When it says men in mentor, the M-E-N at the beginning is not a reference to the English word men, meaning masculine types. It's men and men's. In ancient Greek, it meant wisdom or knowledge, and it went from which we get mental. And it went back to an even older goddess who is the original goddess of wisdom. So mentoring is about bringing those who have a little bit more salty experience with those who are kind of new to the confusions and pain of life in such a way that if it's done honestly with an openness to spirit and an openness to soul, it draws in knowledge that neither one of those have, an imagination that neither one has, and from that, things get healed and whole, and they move towards what we're this morning calling community.
Fantastic. So let's talk a little bit more about the all-day workshop on Saturday. The Friday night events are kind of like the appetizer course in a way, but they definitely open up a lot of context as well as contents while you drum and tell stories and invite people to throw out words and phrases and things that are everybody's dealing with. On Saturday, there's quite a remarkable paragraph in the description of the event. The story written on the walls of the soul is intended to be lived out as the great experiment of each life. The exact medicine for healing are carried inside the individual, waiting to be revealed through life-changing events that initiate the soul and awaken the deep self within. I repeat, the exact medicine for healing are carried inside. I have minimal experience I know the truth of that, but what do you say to people listening to a brief radio interview?
Well, the concise idea comes from an old Native American proverb, which says that we are each born with the medicine that we need to heal ourselves. And, you know, how these old ideas are, they're like vitamins. You know, you take it and it slowly releases itself inside you. And you begin to realize, all right, what does that mean? So one way to look at it is, life is the series of opportunities, challenges, obstacles, and tragedies that strips us down or pushes us inevitably, whether we resist it or not, to the place where we have to awaken to qualities inside ourselves that we didn't know we had. I mean, everybody knows this where it comes to outer stories, like you have all the sports stories, you know, about people coming up against obstacles because they're too small or they're too weak or something, and then they, you know, the Rocky kind of thing, and then they find some resource in themselves they didn't have, and they push their way through, and it's pretty obvious when you see it in the outer world. But the deeper story is when you find it in the inner world. And so, in a sense, you could say either this world is a devastatingly bad place to wind up in because people are given burdens that they can't deal with and given losses that they can never recover from, or each person encounters those tragedies and obstacles that can help awaken them to qualities hidden inside themselves that only come out under great pressure and duress.
Mm-hmm. The way there's so certain... I'm sorry, go ahead, Michael.
No, as you say, I vote for the second one because I'm just not cynical enough to go for the first one.
In nature, an example that comes to mind are there's certain seed pods in forests that will only burst open after a fire.
Exactly. After... what's the mountain?
St. Helens?
Mount St. Helens, thank you. After Mount St. Helens blew up, and I was living here in the Northwest, and everything was covered with gray ash, including, of course, the whole mountain area. And the experts came out and said, wow, that's it. Certain things will never come back, and it's going to take a long time for life to start again, and it wasn't true. first of all, things started growing right away. But the big surprise came when species that they didn't know could grow there grew. And the reason, the explanation apparently, was that it took a certain amount of heat to awaken those seeds. And so there's nature showing it, and then human nature has the same quality. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so let me add another thing. The old idea is that when a person encounters an obstacle, or a culture encounters an obstacle or experiences a great loss, there's really only two choices. They will become a bigger person by discovering things inside themselves they didn't know that they had that were qualities and strengths. Or they will become a smaller person by not having experiences of self-discovery, but instead collapsing out of fear or lethargy. So the workshop is about what tragedies, losses, challenges we've lived through, and what can we learn from them, and what are the challenges, opportunities, obstacles, and losses we are facing now that we can deal better with when we realize what kind of inner gifts, or as you said, I like to call it the hidden genius, is trying to be provoked and brought out into the world. And the premise is from the evening before that the world is in such great trouble that it needs the deep resources of each person and the genius hidden inside each individual.
So you use the word obstacle, and much of Mosaic's work is with whole populations that are often considered obstacles, gang youth, traumatized veterans, the delicate phrase communities in conflict. What have you learned from working with people who are scarred, damaged, on the edge, kind of living yet unborn? There's all kinds of overly poetic ways, no offense, to describe them. But what do you learn over time from working with these different groups?
Well, this is the school I've been in for almost 30 years old. This is the school that we've been in, people working with Mosaic, which are all over the country. And this is where I've gotten these ideas from. For instance, you go to where people think they're comfortable in the culture, and you will find no ideas and usually a lack of hope. I was being interviewed once by Bill Moyers, and he said, boy, where do you find hope in this culture? And I said, well, surprisingly, in all the dark places where no one won't go, because the people that are in the oppression or willing to go to where it is, surprisingly, often they're either already defeated, yes, that happens, or else they have more vitality than other people because they are not hesitating or deluding themselves that things are okay. And so the principle in Mosaic began. Mosaic means, to me, bringing the broken pieces together. And the strongest community is a community that has had to fight its way through its separations and divisions. And just as the strongest part of the body, or the strongest tissue in the body, is scar tissue, where we've been able to heal becomes stronger than the places where we haven't been damaged. And so I use these ideas as a guide of where to do the work. And there's that. And then there's the other thing, that there are so many people hurting right now in Portland, by Portland, everywhere. And, you know, I've been saying these same things for 25 years, but in the past 5 years, no one's arguing anymore. I can go to a very wealthy community and talk about pain and suffering, and everybody goes, yeah, we know what you mean. Whereas 20 years ago, they would pretend they didn't have pain and suffering just because they had money and material goods. So one thing you could say is all the disruption going on is kind of helping everybody to be, or at least everybody but the 1%, let's say, to be in the same boat. And it's when we're in the same boat that we might get the idea of how to survive the storm together.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're needing to wrap up. So if your ears and soul have been whetted by what you've heard the last half hour, Michael Mead will be appearing downtown in Portland talking about the Pathless Path, Following Spirit, Making Soul this Friday evening. followed by a day-long workshop, Initiated Soul, Awakened Self, at University. The information for both these events is at our front desk, so feel free to call if you didn't get it or look on the website. I highly recommend mosaicvoices.org. Michael Mead, thank you so much for taking this time with the KABU people.
Hey, thank you for talking to me, Ralph.
We'll see you Friday.
I look forward to it.
For May 13, 2013. Officials with the Internal Revenue Service appointed during the George W. Bush years stand accused of targeting certain...
With KBOO News, I'm Jimmy Tardy with noon headlines for May 13, 2013. Officials with the Internal Revenue Service appointed during the George W. Bush years stand accused of targeting certain right-wing political groups applying for nonprofit status. The officials reportedly used policies adopted in the Bush presidential administration to focus on applications from groups which had the words Tea Party or Patriot in their names. An audit by the IRS Office of the Inspector General discovered the practices in 2011. In March of 2012, IRS Commissioner and Bush appointee Douglas Shulman denied before Congress that such targeting was occurring. Former Guatemalan dictator and U.S. ally Efren Rios Montt was convicted Friday of genocide for his part in the mass killings of at least 1,700 Ixtli Mayan Indians. Montt was the military ruler of Guatemala from March 1982 to August 1983, and is the first former Central American dictator to be convicted of crimes of genocide in his home country. Montt was sentenced to 80 years in prison. The former general is now 86 years old. Prior to this case, Guatemala's longest sentence was 50 years in prison. The three-judge panel that convicted Montt has ordered prosecutors to continue the effort to bring those responsible to justice. An explosion at a coal mine in the Sichuan province of China has prompted authorities to halt all coal mining in the region to undertake a complete review of safety practices. The explosion on Saturday killed 28 workers and injured 18 more, three critically. China's coal production industry is the world's largest. In 2011, nearly 2,500 miners died in accidents in China. The second highest number of casualties from coal mining is in the U.S., where 48 miners died in 2011. The United States has announced its participation in an international effort aimed at catching offshore tax haven abusers. The U.S. is working with the tax agencies of Great Britain and Australia. They plan to use a huge leak of data about the offshore tax havens, which reportedly contains more than 400 gigabytes of data on individuals who have attempted to avoid paying taxes by using complex offshore arrangements to conceal their identities. The announcement comes in the midst of efforts by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and the group of 20 biggest world economies, the G20, to address the issue of secretive offshore banking. Some estimates put yearly British revenue losses at more than $1 trillion. You can hear more on this issue on Occupy Portland Radio this Wednesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO. That's it for the noon headlines for Monday, May 13th. For more local, national, and international news, tune in every weekday evening at 5 p.m. for the KBOO Evening News, produced by our volunteers in our Portland studios. For KBOO News, I'm Jimmy Tardy. This is KBOO Portland.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the noontime jamboree.
Come on, come on, come on, come on.
Surprised when